Well, good morning again. Well, our next speaker, Sam Matheny, Chief Technology Officer and Executive Vice President of the National Association of Broadcasting. This presentation will explore the trends and industry responses, what lies ahead for radio and TV. So, very happy to have somebody Sam's caliber here to speak, and please welcome him as he comes up, and look forward to his presentation.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you to Michelle and Wendy as well. It's a great honor to be here with you again this year, and I'm excited to be able to speak about transitions in broadcasting. And speaking of transitions, got it. So speaking of transitions, we've just made one, and I'll be talking about the transitions that are impacting our industry. But we're not going to talk just about our industry because we don't operate in a vacuum. And it's not just our industry that is changing, but in many cases it is encouraging, I'll say, us to change. And what are some of those things that are changing? Vehicles are changing. There are now more screens inside of vehicles. We are transitioning from gas to electric vehicles in many cases. And going even further, we're beginning to look at autonomous vehicles. So obviously a lot of our content is consumed in vehicles, and so we need to be responsive to these changes. Also, consumer electronics are changing. You have new gatekeepers that are coming into play. And they're developing new operating systems to drive the television sets. And there are more streaming options, and it is increasingly more difficult to find the broadcast over-the-air signal because of the user interfaces that are in place. And what we transmit is also changing. We're moving from analog to digital. In some cases, we're moving from digital to digital. We're focused on not just the core audio and video, but also on things like metadata, data casting as a completely different audience where you're not broadcasting to people that are watching or listening, but you're broadcasting to machines that are tuning in to get a specific type of signal that helps them do their jobs. And then the skill set. The skill set of the modern engineer is absolutely changing, and you all know that it's all about IT and IP, not just RF. So a lot of things are in transition, but I'm especially happy to be here today because today is Perfect Squares Day. Today is Perfect Squares Day. You have 9, which is a square of 3. You have 16, which is a square of 4. And 25, which is a square of 5. And that's also the Pythagorean theorem, as you may know. And if you want to calculate a hypotenuse, you can do that. But going even further, 2025 is actually 45 squared. So congratulations for this once-in-a-lifetime event of being here on Perfect Squares Day. But what I really want to move into now is talking about AM radio and some of those changes that that are facing AM radio. And from an advocacy perspective, from an NAB advocacy perspective, we are very focused on urging Congress to enact the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act. We have really, this says that if you're going to, this is, directs the Department of Transportation to require motor vehicles to have access to AM radio. And as you all may know, there are a number, started with EVs or electric vehicles that started to pull AM radio, and we'll talk about some of those stats that Q developed later. But this is an act, and it has really, really broad support. Over 280 co-sponsors in the House, and over 61 filibuster-proof co-sponsors in the Senate. And so this is something that we're really working on and have a lot of support from third-party activists or associations. And so we're definitely working on the AM for Every Vehicle Act from an advocacy perspective. From a technology perspective, we've got members of our team that have really been focused on the future of electric vehicles. So not just the notion of AM radio inside an electric vehicle, but also the other interference. And so this is a shot of the Michigan test site. And this site, they actually have charging units built into the road. And so the idea is that your electric vehicle doesn't have to pull over and go to a Tesla station to recharge. You actually charge as you're driving down the road. Or if you're like a commuter bus, you charge on a pad where you stop to load and unload passengers. So this is a shot of it. David Lair on our team, who many of you probably know, as well as Bob Weller, went to here in October of last year. And you can see here the pad is what's on your left. Again, if you're a bus, you pull up, you stop on the pad, you load and unload your passengers. While you're doing that, you get a charge. Or you can actually have it built into the road itself. And these are charging stations, or these pads. They're about a meter long that are actually built into the road. And they operate at 85 kilohertz. And they do a reflective connection with a test vehicle that has a coil mounted on the bottom of it. And those charge either as you're driving or when you're on that pad. Again, at 85 kilohertz, when you look into the harmonics, you get up to 850 kilohertz, and you're now in the AM radio band. And so we all know that the noise floor is something that is increasing. These are studies and measurements that Bob and David took while they were there. And trying to look at the results of what type of interference you would have. They're going to be going back this November to do some additional testing with a better antenna, with going to be doing some audio recordings as well. But we view this not just as the issue of right now today, which is the radio in the car and is there interference that is created by the electric motor, but what about additional noise floor type interference? And what we discovered in the very first tests, and their preliminary, are that it's definitely acute, and it's if you're at that perfect harmonic. But we want to go back and do some additional testing. So we're working to make sure that AM radio can sound as good as it can in the vehicle, and this is an example of work that NAB is doing in that. We're also very focused on HD radio, and you know, when you look at your analog FM with your RDS, and you're talking about a screen-based environment, this is sort of, I'm going to call it the generic view that you get. You get an icon that says you're listening to FM radio. You can use your RDS to provide some very basic information, but increasingly what you want is something that is more like this, which is HD radio, where you can do things like genre, song title, artist, album art. You can have multiple channels. You can have the digital quality and the sound, and ultimately, you know, there's a lot of engineering that goes into this, but this is really about controlling your brand. And controlling your brand in the car and making sure that you're putting your best foot forward to maintain that relationship with the listener. And so leveraging HD radio to do that is a great way to improve your broadcast. There are about 115 million vehicles equipped with HD radio on the road today. So we're really starting to get into an audience set that you can have meaningful engagement on these additional channels, and then you also have additional opportunities to provide advertising and other ways of making money through the metadata. The important thing about this is all of this data is in band. You're not using an internet connection. It's coming over that same digital signal that is bringing you the audio content as well. So you have a completely holistic solution that's provided in-band via HD radio. Another big trend that is happening now is connected radio as well, and that's where you're combining your traditional radio signal with internet connectivity that's in the vehicle. When we look at that, you look at, this is AutoStage, this is a product by Xperia and DTS, but you're looking at a completely different type of user interface and experience. You're looking at station branding that is built into the navigation of what channel you're going to select. And it's really a robust experience that is designed to make sure that radio is on par or even better than what the streaming services are able to offer. So this is some AutoStage photos Juan took last night or the day before that are right here in Madison. So you can see that in AutoStage, you've got your analog signal, and then the metadata is coming in over the internet. The other thing you can see is that this is applies equally well to AM radio. So this is not just an FM thing. So very impressed with the work that AutoStage is doing and their ability to help stations maintain their brand. But additionally, looking even further out, they're integrating with TiVo. So it's no longer going to be just radio content, but there will also be video content that is available. This is currently in some of the higher end vehicles. BMW in particular has video in the vehicle. Now this video is leveraging, again, the internet connectivity, so it's a streaming video service. But if you're a broadcaster thinking about how to serve your community and reach new audiences and to extend that reach into the vehicle from a television standpoint, there's going to be new opportunities offered by AutoStage with TiVo. I talked about this, not sure what happened there. Seemed to have switched. Okay, thank you. AutoStage with TiVo, let me go back. I talked about this. This is some work that Q did. So not only is it artist information you can present, but you can also present interactive or video-branded advertising. But this is a dashboard scorecard. And if you go to the Q's website, I think you can actually download this. But they went out and actually took a in-person survey of the top 100 selling vehicles, and they looked at what is in those vehicles. And you can see FM radio is in 100% of them. AM radio is in 98% of them, but you come down and you can see where Apple CarPlay is, where Android Auto is, as well as these other services. So what Q is focused on is providing an offering for that radio stations allows them to, whether it's RDS or whether it's HD radio or whether it's a connected radio such as AutoStage, you can provide an advertising solution that drives new revenue for your station. So this is leveraging that metadata. It's leveraging that transition to be able to provide new opportunities for broadcasters. When you're in a connected radio, you also have the ability in some models to do service following. So the idea there is if you're listening to your radio station, you begin to drive out of the market, your radio detects that, you can now switch over to a streamed version of it. When you drive back into really good coverage, you can switch back to the over-the-air broadcast, and it's a seamless transition. So that is another benefit of the connected radio. And then, of course, when you're in this environment, you have that two-way connectivity, you can collect analytics, first-party data that is available to the station through a relationship with Xperia and DTS. And so this QR code actually links to the portal that they have where you can sign up to be a partner and look at what sorts of data are available to you. So it's a different way of thinking about your audience as well as engaging with them. So, and this is just a sample of some of the data that you can get in analytics. They have a very in-depth portal that's available. So I want to pivot now to next-gen TV, but let me pause for a minute and see, you know, if there are any questions in particular about what we're doing with radio or what you've seen here as it relates to HD or AM or otherwise. And if they're not, we'll keep rolling. If there are, we'll happy to take them. Okay, I'm going to take that as keep moving. So we're going to keep going now, and I'm going to shift over to next-gen TV, which is another big transition that the industry is undertaking, and I want to talk about what that looks like. So this is where we are with our current ATSC 3.0 deployments. ATSC 3.0 in the United States is branded as next-gen TV when you're talking about consumers. So I may switch back and forth between next-gen TV and ATSC 3.0. ATSC 3 is the Advanced Television Systems Committee. It's an international standards development organization, and we're currently operating on a digital standard that is affectionately referred to as ATSC 1.0. Used to just be ATSC, but now that we're into incremental improvements, we're talking about ATSC 1 is what we're broadcasting in today. Predominantly, we're in ATSC 3. So we're live in 80 markets, and that's 103 stations in 80 markets offering 437 program channels of content. And if you do the math on that, that's about four or five stations, program channels, that are sharing a single ATSC 3 transmission out there. So for example, in Washington, D.C., WHUT is the host station, sometimes referred to as a lighthouse station. And then that station is playing host for the ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox affiliate, plus their channels. So there's five channels that are being offered on that single ATSC 3 transmission. When I back up and think about our industry, I think as we are transitioning to ATSC 3, our industry is working together as we have not historically done. We are working better together than we ever have in the past because we realize that there is an existential need to move to this new standard for broadcasting to remain a relevant source. So what are we doing from an advocacy perspective? I want to talk a little bit just about the transition. So the FCC actually approved permissive use of ATSC 3.0 in October of 2017. So what does permissive use mean? It means it's voluntary. If you want to do it, you can do it. That's basically what the FCC said, and they're like, but guess what? You're not getting any new spectrum to do it like you did last time. And that's why you're seeing all of this channel sharing, and that's why you're seeing broadcasters working together as they have historically not done. But earlier this year, NAB filed a petition for rulemaking at the FCC that would say, hey, we want to complete the transition to ATSC 3.0. We want the entire nation to go to ATSC 3.0, and we're going to turn 1.0 off. And we're going to do that in two phases. Phase one is going to be by early 2028, and we're going to do the top 55 markets first. So we're going to do the top 55 markets first. That means 70% roughly of U.S. television households will at that point be transitioned to ATSC 3, and ATSC 1 in those markets would cease. Now, this is for full power stations. This is not for low power. We're only talking about full power. And then by 2030, the remaining markets would transition to ATSC 3, again with the goal of turning ATSC 1 off. And you look back and you say, wow, 2017 to 2030, you know, that's 13 years for a transition. And some people are like, that's crazy long. Other people might say, well, that's kind of fast. If you look back at the last transition from analog to digital, it took about that same time. I was at WREL-TV in 1996 when we turned on the first digital experimental station. And then we turned off analog in 2009. So if you look at this transition as and the petition we filed, it puts us on about the exact same pace for the analog to digital transition, except that we're doing a digital to digital transition now. And like the last transition, when it first started, there were no hard dates set. You know, there were metrics and targets and things like that, and so we're really following a very similar pattern as we did in the last transition. What would the next step be? The next step would be for a notice of proposed rulemaking. So we are hoping that that will happen in Q4. We'd love to see a notice of proposed rulemaking come out, and then what you'll see is comments and then reply comments. So basically everybody gets an opportunity to comment on the proposed plan and give their perspectives, and then people get to read what everybody said and then reply comments. And then hopefully the FCC ultimately comes out with a firm rulemaking. So those are the steps that we're going through right now with this transition. From an advocacy standpoint at the FCC. We were very encouraged by, this is a partial statement, but this is the first couple of sentences from FCC Chairman Carr. And this came out earlier this month. I think he actually issued this on September 2nd. And, you know, he's focused on accelerating the transition and says that the FCC is working to support and encourage a timely transition. So we took this as a very positive sign for ATSC 3 and the work that we're doing, and we think that it sends a signal to the rest of the industry as to where things are headed. As part of any transition, you have to enable folks to get involved and to become educated on what's going on. And as part of the next gen transition, we have a program called Pilot, which is where we do a lot of our research and development. In our Pilot program, we have set up something called a Next Gen TV Fellowship. We launched this initially with Howard University. Howard actually owns WHUT, which is the host station in DC I was mentioning earlier, but we have expanded it to University of Missouri, importantly, the University of Minnesota, as well as Clark University Atlanta is coming on board this year. So this is a program that has support from AWS. You can see the students here. What we do is we bring those students to Washington, D.C. We let them work in our lab. We teach them about next-gen TV, and then they adopt a project that they do. Now, the team from Minnesota actually built an interactive ATSC 3 application that was focused on I'm going to call it hyper-local content, but they developed an app that was specific to the state hockey championship for high school, the high school state hockey championship. And they developed this application, and it gave you access to look at information about the players, about the teams, to access previous video on demand, and to engage in that broadcast in a new and a different way. Those projects then come to NAB Show, and what you see here on the right is FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez is receiving a presentation from the students at the University of Missouri about the project that they did, which was based on data casting and improving outcomes via telehealth. So wide range of applications that can be built and things that can be done, but what we're doing is we're actively engaging that next generation of technologist and engineer to think about it. And they do it across departments. So there's business people, there's journalism people, there's technical people, and we think that's a really great model and one that we're focused on with NextGen. I was having dinner last night with Bill Hubbard, and and we were talking about the work that he's doing at the Duke Wright Media Institute, and we were talking about an amazing program that we have a blog on Pilot that we wrote about. We call it our Pilot Broadcast Blog. We did a write-up, I think it was in late August, about the work that's going on at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. And I'm just so excited about that program and about the way they're creating a broadcast engineering emphasis and the way that they got creative and said, wait, we have all the parts and pieces for this program already here. Let's just package them in a new way and offer them as a broadcast engineering emphasis. And so they didn't really have to invent new curriculum, but what they did have to do is package curriculum that already existed in a new way. And I just think that's really, really innovative. And then taking it the next step, it goes from the opportunity for an associate's degree to a bachelor's through a pathway program that they're developing two by two with Madison College. So a lot of great thinking going on right here in Wisconsin, and I'm just super, super excited about that. And I think that somewhat mirrors some of the work that we're doing with our Next Gen TV Fellowship. Another new program that we've got that is really targeted at stations is we have received a grant from the Knight Foundation. And the Knight Foundation really focuses on developing communities and supporting journalism. And we were able to secure a $2.5 million grant for a Next Gen TV News Lab. This is a program that will run for multiple years. It kicked off just recently, and it will run through 2028. And what we're doing is engaging our members directly, and they're coming up with projects that they want to develop. And they're saying, oh, I would build this new next-gen application or this new use of next-gen TV if only I had the funds. And NAB now, with the support of the Knight Foundation, is able to have a program to vet those projects, to approve them, to fund them, to also support them with technical expertise. And this is really, you know, if you look at that time frame, it overlaps perfectly as we're looking at the transition, because this runs now through 2028, and we're talking about the top 55 markets in our FCC petition transitioning in 2028. So what we're trying to do is say, hey, when you hit the ground with Next Gen TV and you make that transition, you're going to hit the ground running with newsrooms that understand the technology, that have developed new applications, that are going to be able to say, I am better serving my community because I now have Next Gen TV and the capabilities that it affords. We are not transitioning alone, though. You may know that South Korea first adopted ATSC3 back, their first broadcast was in 2016 with the Olympics. Obviously, I talked about us. Brazil is another major market. Just as we brand TV, or we brand it as Next Gen TV in Brazil, they brand it as DTV Plus. And their president recently signed the final decree outlining their transition to ATSC3. Not only are they saying we're going to ATSC3, they call it DTV Plus, but it uses the same physical layer as ATSC3 and a lot of the same technologies that have been standardized in ATSC3. But not only are they doing that, but they are requiring television makers to either build in an antenna or include one with every television set that's sold. They are also requiring something called prominence. So if you have bought a TV recently, you may turn it on and you get buried in a Roku menu. And when you finally get to your TV channel, you can watch your TV channel. If you turn your TV off, it doesn't go back to that channel. It brings you back into that Roku menu. Right? That's just an example. A lot of the manufacturers are doing that now. And what they have is a prominence requirement. So there is basically a local TV button on the remote so that you always have one button access to your local over-the-air broadcast programming. And so unlike the U.S., they've also allocated some new spectrum. But this is a major market. I mean, this is 70% of people watch over the air here, and it's a really big television market, and we think that that is going to have some good impact on our transition as well due to economies of scale and things of that nature. So we're excited for what's happening in Brazil. I'm going to move now to an application that we at NAB invented really starting back in 2020, and then we filed for patents back in 2021, and it's called BPS. And BPS stands for Broadcast Positioning System. And if that sounds like GPS or the Global Positioning System, that's on purpose. And so basically it is a terrestrial equivalent of GPS. And what it does is it leverages ATSC-3 signals to do so. But why do we even care about that? If you've been following what's been going on around the world, you know that GPS is a it's been exceptionally reliable, but it is a very low power signal, and it is on known frequencies that come from space. So that means it's easily jammed and it's easily spoofed. It's also vulnerable to things like solar storms. And what has happened is GPS has become an invisible utility. It started off that it was something just meant for our warfighters. But when it was opened up to civil use and reception, it has become an invisible utility that is really foundationally just a time transfer mechanism. I need to have hyper-accurate timing so that I can time align my synchrophasers so that electricity can travel across the grid. I need to time align my cell towers so that my 5G and 6G connections are there, and my phone calls and my data connections get properly handed off. I need to make sure that every equity trade or financial transaction that is made is timestamped within a certain degree of accuracy. Usually these are in the order of magnitude of a microsecond of, or 1/1,000,000th of a second down to maybe a few nanoseconds or 1/1,000,000,000th of a second. So those are sort of the parameters that are happening. NIST did a study in 2019 that said the United States economy has a risk of $1 billion a day. Now, I'm not sure what that is in today's dollars, but $1 billion a day, because all of these systems would fail because it's be a cascading, you know, series of events. And so that is what is at stake. President Trump, in his first term, issued Executive Order 13905 that said, basically, Houston, we have a problem, and we need to fix it. And, well, we have come to the table since then with BPS as a terrestrial equivalent to GPS. So what does BPS do? It is a time, and it transfers time, and it can provide time and position using an ATSC-3 signal. It works completely independent of GPS, internet, cellular connectivity, which makes it an independent offering that can therefore complement or augment GPS. How does it work? Well, what we're doing is we're taking advantage of the new signal structure of ATSC 3.0, and we are announcing the bootstrap time of emission in the preamble of the signal. So basically we're saying this is what time this signal was emitted, and then we're doing a small data cast in a PLP, a physical layer pipe, that says this is the location of the tower that was transmitted from. So in essence, that is exactly the same thing that a GPS satellite does. It says this is what time I transmitted this signal, and this is where the satellite was in orbit when it was transmitted. And then there's a bunch of fancy math to figure out, you know, your position, and then allow you to do navigation. We're doing the exact same thing with a stationary television tower, which has a lot of benefits. But the one thing I want to highlight, if I get it right, is right down here. GNSS, it's a global navigation satellite system. GPS is a form of GNSS. There are others. Russia has one called GLONASS. China has one called Baidu. Europe has one called Galileo. But we have GNSS independent time. So there's this concept of a day without space. And that is the idea that if we lost space for whatever reason, because Russia wanted to set off a nuclear bomb in space and wipe out our satellites, or because of a massive solar storm, or because of spoofing and jamming here on the ground. If we lost space, we're working without, when you trace back, there is no dependence on GPS. And so we have independent timing, and that really makes it very valuable. Now, what does it look like when you get to the station level? And this is one of the big things that we're talking about, is this is existing infrastructure. So if you're looking at this picture, all of these blocks, the tower, the transmission chain, the amplifiers, the control room, the RF combiner, all of that stuff's already in place. What we're doing is we're coming in and we're adding that GNSS independent time, and then we're adding a synchronizer. So we're taking advantage of existing infrastructure, and we're adding the ability to insert this synchronized time and then transmit it. And this is a short video that is going to have some of the nation's preeminent experts. One is from the Critical Infrastructure Institute, PhD. One is going to be the principal time and frequency scientist at NIST, or the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They are the keepers of weights and measures for our nation. And then one is going to be a retired four-star Air Force general who used to oversee Space Command when he was with the Air Force. So can you play that video, please? He's saying beautiful things. We rehearsed this, I promise. I'll leave it to you guys to determine how long we want to try to fix this. But basically, we've got a lot of experts. We have not been doing this in a vacuum. We were very intentional. In 2022, we went to an organization, the DOT, the Department of Transportation. They have civil responsibility for position, navigation, and timing systems, PNT. We went to a round table, and we met with the Deputy Assistant Secretary, and actually even the Secretary Buttigieg showed up at the meeting to make a token appearance as well. That speaks to the level at which this is being considered. But we've been engaged with that group, as well as there is actually a government committee that is focused on providing resilient timing. There's called the Space-Based PNT Advisory Board, and we have been actively engaged with them. And since that time when we first presented the concept, we've been working with them to make sure that BPS meets their timing needs. And the short story, we can just skip ahead. The short story is that NIST, again, the keeper of weights and measures, for for our country. They have said that BPS is comparable to or better than GPS for time transfer. So when you're looking at all those lifeline critical infrastructures that rely on time, BPS is right up there. There's also been a study done by the Department of Homeland Security that says that BPS is the recommended solution. We can try it again.
To the front of the pack because nothing else is in place right now.
Okay, so we'll just carry on. Okay, so then earlier this year, we did a live demonstration at the Assured PNT Summit. This was a summit that was hosted in Washington, D.C. And we had a booth there, and we were showing BPS. We were the only folks to do a live demonstration. And what you see in this picture is our antenna. So we are in downtown Washington, D.C. We got one of those little, you know, $20, $30 stick-up antennas. We slapped it up on a beam. And even though we're in a dense urban environment, we were able to do a live BPS demo. In that room, we had folks from the U.S. Naval Observatory come up to our booth, and they were like, whoa, what are you guys doing? So we have their attention. We presented at the U.S. Naval Observatory back in 2023, and folks were like, oh, this is interesting. It sounds, you know, keep us posted. But they came to this event, and they're like, wait a minute, you guys have made this real. So we're pretty excited about that, and those conversations continue. We've also developed a new four-channel receiver. You can transfer time with one station, but when you combine three or more, that's when you can start to do positioning. And so this is a receiver that we've developed, and we have it up and running in our lab now. You can receive four different channels, and you can combine time, and then you can begin to calculate your position, which then, you know, leads to navigation. But right now, what we're very focused on is timing. This has to be deployed as a single network. And the way we've architected it is with leaders and followers. So for example, in Washington, D.C., WHUT would be our leader station. Sinclair Broadcast Group and Harvey Arnold have been exceptionally supportive of what we're doing. And WNUV over in Baltimore is now a follower station. So what does that mean? That means that WNUV in Baltimore, as it relates to transferring time, does not use GPS at all. They listen to WHUT as their source of time, and then they retransmit it. So they are GPS independent, and one of the things that we're doing is we're beginning to study how many hops can we do and still maintain the nanosecond level accuracy that we need to. But we see this being deployed as sort of a mesh network that is self-synchronizing, again, working completely independent. If you think about the way EAS is deployed in terms of having a daisy chain and a mesh network, it's sort of similar to that, except instead of being concerned with an emergency alert or presidential level alert, you're talking about transferring time proactively. So this is how we see it. This is the predicted coverage that we've got. Basically, everything in green or inside can receive a BPS signal. So we're getting hundreds of miles out into coastal waters in some cases. And the key to this is that physical layer pipe that I mentioned, and the fact that we can apply different modulation encoding. So we are actually, the modulation encoding on the preamble and on that physical layer pipe is about 20 dB difference And it's below the noise floor, about 20 dB difference than what you need to actually be able to decode the audio and video or the main payload, if you're thinking back to that earlier thing. So if you're saying, hey, critical infrastructure, I'm a fixed site, I have a little tower, I can put up an antenna, you know, maybe 50 meters in the air, on average it's predicted that you can receive 17 different signals. At 70 signals, and at 1.5 meters, it's over 15. So we think this has a lot of promise in terms of deployment. Again, one tower can do time, but the key thing is when you begin to integrate this with GPS, because GPS isn't going away. Now you've got a method of detecting when GPS has been compromised, because you have a completely independent system. So you can detect GPS spoofing, and you can also integrate BPS with GPS to do hybrid solutions. So maybe you only have a few GPS satellites that are compromised. Well, maybe you slot in a BPS transmission, and if they're coming from the same time scale, working at the same level of accuracy, you never miss a beat. So we have a complete monitoring and network operations center that we're building out to help to make sure that everything stays synchronized and to know that when things may be going awry so that we can proactively fix them. And then these are a lot of the advantages that I've already talked about, really the infrastructure being there. It's broadcast. You've got a passive consumer device. You're not relying on any sort of two-way connection with the potential bottleneck in there. You're operating at a very high power. You're operating on diverse frequencies, 210 megahertz of spectrum, spread across 35 channels, and then you've got the nationwide coverage. So we really are excited about this as an ATSC-3 application. And the FCC earlier this year issued an NOI, or a notice of inquiry, looking for complementary PNT solutions, and we certainly filed that we think BPS can be one of those, and it's yet another reason to expedite that transition to ATSC-3. So if you care to learn more about BPS, we do have a complete website that is set up. It's at nab.org/BPS. We've got all our technical white papers that we've written. We've co-authored papers with scientists from DOT, from members of the Space-Based PNT Advisory Board, with scientists from NIST, have had peer-reviewed papers at other PNT conferences, so you can learn more about it there if you're interested. And with that, I just want to say thank you for this opportunity. It is a great pleasure to be here. Michelle and Wendy and just the entire team do an amazing job of bringing together folks, I would say, from the Midwest, but really it goes even further than that. So thank you for having me, and I'm, again, happy to answer any questions. Not seeing any. Oh, you got one?
Is there a timeline for the full implementation of
the station? So full implementation with BPS, or okay, yeah. So what we have been talking about is folding BPS into the ATSC-3 transition. So as you are making that transition from ATSC-1 to ATSC-3 with, again, a couple of additions to it, very low cost, you could integrate it. And then by 2028, we'd be in a large majority of areas. But by 2030, we would have BPS deployed out nationwide. So that's the timing. If the transition ends up going faster or taking a little longer, that's what it would be paired with.
So this may have been covered then. Is this something that the stations would incur that cost? They purchase the equipment, or is this?
So that's a great question. And so what we're doing right now we have received a grant from the Department of Transportation because they're studying these complementary PNT solutions. It's public. You can find it on a website somewhere. But they gave us or are giving us just shy of $750,000 to deploy BPS and test it at a real critical infrastructure site. Part of that $750,000 goes to buy the equipment and also fund the station for providing the BPS signal. So we're hopeful that that can be a blueprint and that stations will have, you know, not just a public service obligation commitment, because it does fit perfectly with our public interest obligations, but also a financial incentive to offer BPS. And again, in the grand scheme of going to 3.0, BPS is a small cost, but we know stations count every penny, so that's important.
What percentage of household TV sets can receive ATSC 3.0 at this point?
So at this point, there have been about 15 million next-gen TV sets sold. So that's one answer. So the other answer is that you need to be in a market that has a ATSC 3.0 signal. So there's not necessarily a clean way for me to give you an exact this percentage can do it. But if you said I've got, you know, round numbers, 120 million U.S. television households and 15 million sets have been sold, if you assume that that is one set per household, then you begin to get a percentage. So we're still pretty low, but right now the CTA is forecasting, Consumer Technology Association is forecasting that by 2028, that 80% of all TVs sold will be next-gen TVs. And what's happening is the consumer electronics companies have different approaches to next-gen. Sony only makes next-gen TVs. There are some low-cost manufacturers that make no next-gen TVs, like Vizio. And then you've got folks like Samsung, TCL, Hisense, LG, and others, that Panasonic, that are sort of, they're tiering their, you know, if you buy one of the more expensive higher-end sets, it will have next-gen, but if you're buying at the lower end, it probably won't. So we want that to go to, we want everybody to be like Sony and have every TV set be a next-gen TV set. So I talked all around your question without giving you a direct answer. I'm sorry. All right, I think I'm at time. Thank you all so much.